we are familiar with the story found in 1 Samuel chapter 15. 1 Samuel chapter 15, this is where King Saul ends up having his kingdom taken away from him, and we want to kind of read some of this to understand why. If we look at 1 Samuel chapter 15, look at the first two verses, 1 Samuel 15, verse 1 and 2. Samuel also said to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people, over Israel. Now, therefore, heed the voice of the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he ambushed him on the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and attack Amalek, verse 3, and utterly destroy all that they have, and do not spare them, but kill both men, or man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." So that would be 1 Samuel, the first three verses. Now I would ask a question. Are these instructions that have been given to Saul by the prophet of God, Samuel, unclear or confusing in any way? It's pretty straightforward, isn't it? And of course, as we read that, there's nothing that's vague about what he is instructed to do. Go attack the Amalekites, utterly destroy all of them. They have, and don't spare any of them. All the people and all of the animals. But when the Israelites go and attack the Amalekites, look at verse 7 through 9. Saul attacked the Amalekites from Havilah all the way to Shur, which is east of Egypt. He also took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatling, the lambs, and all that was good, and were unwilling to destroy them, but everything despised and worthless that they utterly destroyed. So we would ask the question, well, had Saul carried out God's commands? And we would read that and say, absolutely not. Not at all. So when Samuel arrives at Gilgal, where Saul is, here's what Saul says in verse 13. Samuel went to Saul, and Saul said to him, "Blessed are you of the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord." And we've already determined just in what we've read that he didn't carry out the commandments of God. They've spared Agag, the king, and they have kept the best of the animals. But anything that was worthless, well, that they went ahead and destroyed. So here's what Samuel's reply is in verse 14. He says, "What then is the bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear?" And I'm sure that, just picture this, Samuel walks up and he says, "We've done everything that you told us to do," and in the background you're getting, "Bah, bah," and you've got, you know what a cow does, you're chatting all the racket the cow makes, that's what it's talking about. I could do that better if I tried, I can make a pretty good cow. But anyway, that's the sound, and you hear all this going on, and your first thought is, right, that's exactly what you did. Then why am I hearing all these sheep carrying on, and all these animals, and all the racket? But, you know, he says that I've done this. Now, this is not a lesson about how important it is to obey the Lord's commands. But that's a great lesson, but that's not what we're looking at this morning. And that's well established in these verses. So let's move on. Look at verse 15. Saul said, "They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we have utterly destroyed." This also is not a lesson about how you don't blame other people, because that's what he's doing. You know, you notice he didn't say, "I spared Agag, the king." He wanted him for himself. He points and says, "The people did all of that." This isn't a lesson about blaming others. That's another great lesson that we could look at. But look at what's said in the next verse. Samuel said to Saul, "Be quiet." And that's powerful. Be quiet. Let's continue reading. "I will tell you what the Lord said to me last night. And he said to him, 'Speak on.' And Samuel said, 'When you were little, in your own eyes, were you not head of the tribes of Israel? And did not the Lord anoint you king over Israel? Now the Lord sent you on a mission and said, go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Lord? And Saul said to Samuel, but I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me and brought Agag, the king of Amalek. I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took of the plunder, sheep and oxen, the best of the things which should have been utterly destroyed to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal. That's not a lesson on, again, the ends justifies the means. Another great point. So here's what Samuel said. Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. Now, I've brought lessons on that. That's another great lesson on obeying the Lord. That's what we're talking about. But here's what I want us to look at is the very next verse, verse 23. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. And stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he also has rejected you from being king. I want to talk to you this morning about what Samuel said here about stubbornness in verse 23. What kind of man would deny any wrongdoing? A stubborn man. What kind of king would fail to acknowledge his failure in doing what had been clearly communicated to him by the Lord to destroy the Amalekites? A stubborn man. A stubborn man. And so this morning we want to look at the seriousness of stubbornness. It's not a noble trait. It is not something that, it's a sinful character flaw. Remember, a while back we talked about the sin of murmuring and grumbling and complaining. And we talk about anger and wrath and losing our temper and self-control. Well, here we have another one of those that so often we just think about, well, he's just stubborn. She's just stubborn. But this is not something that the Lord is pleased with at all. And so let me ask a question. Who in your family is stubborn? All right, I caught a little thing right here. Caroline just turned and looked at Rebecca. Oh, see, now they're starting to point. Well, here's the illustration. It's always somebody else. Oh, you're the stubborn one. Trust me, we have these conversations in our home. I think she's stubborn. She thinks I'm stubborn. And a while back, I brought a lesson on loving her and respecting him. How well does stubbornness work in a house? All right, so we want to talk about this. We want to talk about this from the perspective of how God saw. Again, all the things we talked about in this lesson are great. In fact, I brought a lesson years ago on the first part. I spent a whole lesson on rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. And I talked about how evil witchcraft is. I don't believe I brought that lesson here. And how bad it is. And God says, that's what I want you to understand about rebellion. But I do want to focus in on what he says about stubbornness. Amazingly, we rarely see our very own stubbornness, but you know what? We quickly and easily see it in somebody else. And that's just true about a lot of things. We look in the mirror, and it's just not us. But yet, God said, Saul, a big problem here is that you are stubborn. And I equate that to iniquity. And I equate that to idolatry. And so what I want to look at is the definition of stubbornness. Well, if you look at somebody like Webster's, it says unreasonable or perversely unyielding. Okay, so this idea of stubborn is you just won't yield. But it's like some of us would say, well, you know, not every time. There's times I yield. There's times I give in for the... You know, this is something that is pretty, this idea perversely, it's a severe, but I don't want us to go to a severeness. I want to maybe look at it from the times that we dig in. A good synonym that is found is this idea of obstinance, or obstinate, which is when you try to look at what does that mean? It's fixed. When you think about stubbornness, you think about what? I always think about you're digging in. You know, it's just like I'm not going to be moved. And that's the idea behind that. I found it interesting that when I was looking at the meaning of the Hebrew word, the root of it, and I haven't figured this out, so this is one of those when you're on your way out the door, you might go, I think this is what this, because you may know something I don't know, but the root is this idea of pecking at. And so when I was like, what is this? And best I came up with was an ornery old a hen. And so I thought, well, maybe there's something there, but again, I didn't figure all that out as to the root. So I'll throw that out because you may actually be able to connect the link there for me. But one of the other things that you see is pig-headed. And so we'll look at some other expressions that we use. But this is the idea of being fixed and being obstinate. And so Saul was being stubborn. He would not admit to having done anything wrong. In fact, you imagine Samuel's walking up. There's all these sheep and all these animals everywhere. He hears the noise, and Saul's like, "We've done what you told us to do." And it's like, who would do that? Unless you're stubborn, especially when it's pointed out, right? And sadly, it's only after, we'll look at verse 24 now, it's only after Samuel has told him that he's been rejected as king, that then finally Saul says, "I've sinned, for I've transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your words, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice." It was only after God said, "Well, then I'm going to take the kingdom away from you." Then he finally acknowledges his sin. And so we think of stubbornness in that regard. So let me give you a secular illustration of this. There is the, and you may be familiar with this. I was not familiar with this, but Hiro Onodo is this gentleman here. He was 18 years old when he enlisted into the Imperial Japanese infantry, Army infantry, and that was in the year of 1940. He was trained in intelligence, and so he was an officer. And in 1944, in the World War II, he was sent to Lubang Island in the Philippines. And his orders that he was given on the island was he was supposed to hamper any of the enemy's attacks, and he was supposed to try to keep, you know, the United States from taking the island and all this stuff. Well, the war ended in October of 1945. And so they had all of these people that were out in the hiding and so forth. And so they dropped leaflets all over, letting them know that the war between the Allies and the Japanese and the Germans was over. And he had three other men with him at the time, and they found the leaflets and they didn't believe it. They thought it was a hoax, and so they just kept right on doing what they were doing. In 1945, one of them, he just walked away on his own, and I think it was like 6 months later, he finally surrendered. In 1952, letters from family members were dropped, and pictures urging these men to surrender. The war's over. They believed it was a trick. They kept right on going. In 1954, one of the men was killed by a single shot. They would have skirmishes with some of the local police. In 1972, the last of the two men was killed by gunshot from a local policeman. And that left this man. On March the 9th in 1974, Hiro's commanding officer went to Lumbang to relieve him of his duties. They tracked him down and said, "You've got to go tell him the war is over." And after persuading him, actually in the middle of that, he called him a hippie friend that came out and tracked him down and found him in like 4 days and sat down with him and tried to convince him that the war was over. And so when he came out and said, "I found him, he's still alive," they talked his commanding officer to go, and the commanding officer finally rescinds his orders and commands him and tells him that the war is over. And so here we have him being let out in 1974 after he was finally persuaded that the war was over. And here he is surrendering his military sword over and relinquished of his duties. Now, what could account for his failure to be convinced that the war had ended? Because really what happened is he had dug in. He wasn't going to be convinced. He would not be convinced. And let this sink in. 29 years after the war ended. 29 years. And you know what else? He wasn't the last one. There was one other man. And I don't have his name. I had read it. But there was one that later that year was the last. What could account for that? I think it's a lot of stubbornness. That you could say, well, he wasn't going to, you know, in his orders, there's a lot. But you know what? 29 years and you couldn't be convinced that the world had moved on? And so there's a seriousness with regards to stubbornness. And so God equates this with iniquity and idolatry. Iniquity is wickedness. It's lawlessness. It includes all the wicked things that you can think of. He says that stubbornness is as iniquity. Everything that's wicked. You see, and then he says it's idolatry. You understand how God hates idolatry. Look at Exodus 34. Exodus 34. I appreciate it again, Brother Easter's prayer, because he praised God. We believe that you are the true and living God. We believe that you are the loving God. We believe you are the Creator. There is only one true and living God. And so what does chapter 34 of Exodus in verse 14 say? It says, "For you shall worship no other God, for the Lord, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God." That's what he thinks about idolatry. He abhors idolatry. Because as we've studied even recently, there's nothing in the idol. It's made by human hands. It's fashioned by man. And he carries it around. It can't move. God hates that. So to equate stubbornness, understand, to equate stubbornness with wickedness, all wickedness, to equate it with idolatry and relay that to Saul and to us, it says this is a serious thing about how stubbornness and our stubbornness is a sin. Look at Romans chapter 2. Romans chapter 2. And in Romans chapter 2, let's look at the first six verses together. "Therefore, you are inexcusable, O man, whoever you are, who judge. For in whatever you judge another, you condemn yourself. For you who judge practice the same things. But we know that the judgment of God is according to to truth against those who practice such things. And do you think this, O man, you who judge those practicing such things and doing the same, that you will escape the judgment of God? Or do you despise the riches of His goodness, forbearance and long-suffering, not knowing that the goodness of God leads you to repentance? But in accordance with your hardness of your impenitent heart, you are treasuring up for yourself wrath in the day of wrath and revelation of the righteous judgment of God, who will render to each one according to his deeds." Verse 5, the New American Standard reads, "Stubbornness and unrepentant heart." A failure to admit doing wrong, sin, missing the mark. And you won't repent of it. You will not turn. You have a heart that just won't turn away from sin. You won't acknowledge it. You won't turn from it and to God. And so what do you see in this passage that awaits the stubborn heart, the stubborn individual? What do you see awaits them? Again, this is how serious it is. What awaits the stubborn man or woman is the wrath, the day of wrath, when Jesus returns. I think of 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, that Jesus is going to return with His mighty angels in flaming fire, taking vengeance on those that obey not the gospel. They don't believe in God and they do not obey the gospel. And so, again, we think about stubbornness. It's not cute. It's not. And in a child, we laugh and you look and say, "Oh, that, you know, she's just being stubborn." It's not cute. As a parent, it's really something you have to work on. Because if it's not dealt with at an early age, like I was talking about the other day about lying and things of that nature, those are the things that you need to not have in your character, because those are the things that they grow up and they're a stubborn adult and they won't obey the gospel because they've dug in. And so it's a sin. That's what I wanted to convey there. So let's talk about some traits and of what it means to be stubborn. I mean, we can talk about what's digging in. So here's some traits. You will not yield. And we're not talking about standing for truth. We're not talking about standing for truth or your conviction of faith. You know, conviction is you're not going to be moved because you believe this to be true. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about a person who won't change their mind. They won't give in. And as I said, how's that work in a loving relationship between the husband and the wife? It doesn't. You've got one that won't be moved. And so to understand that, you know, they won't consider what the other person is saying because they've become obstinate. And there isn't going to be any yielding of one's position. Another thing is they like to argue. Like Saul, the stubborn person has a hard time admitting that they're wrong, so they argue to avoid any admission of wrongdoing. And if you look, which I did, I went and I tried to understand, you know, sometimes you look and say, well, how do the professional people, like psychologists, how do they handle stubbornness? And one of the things is when you're reading some of the traits and so forth is when they can't win the argument, what are they going to do? Well, they're going to cast insult. They're going to go and attack because they're not going to yield that they're wrong. And so that's something that just all of that I've described, certainly we can step back and say, well, that certainly wouldn't convey the right attitude or heart or character of a Christian. Jesus certainly didn't demonstrate any of that type of character. And if we're supposed to imitate him and to conform to his image, certainly we can see that this would not be something that God would be happy with. Let's look at a few examples. Pharaoh in Exodus chapter 7 and in verse 14. I think it's found, if you were to try to see it in Pharaoh, it's found in the idea of his heart being hardened. It's like he would say, yeah, you can go. And then he changed his mind. And he was stubborn about all of the plagues that he saw. You know, he would sit and, you know, at first it was, well, bring the magicians and let them do the same thing. And they kept up for just a couple of them with the changing of the water to blood, though I'm sure it wasn't on the scale that Moses had done. And they kept up with some of the frogs, but after that, they were just, it was out of their league. And so basically, you know, in verse 14, it says, so the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is hard. He refuses to let the people go. And so it's this hardening of the heart. And basically in this idea of hard is he's not going to yield. He's not going to let the people go. He's just not. He's going to dig in. He's just not going to let it happen. Until his firstborn child is struck dead. But even then, after he lets him go, he's like, oh, that was a mistake. And he sends his army after him. And I think you see it in Pharaoh, a stubborn child. Look at this as a parent. I want you to think about Deuteronomy chapter 21. This one just, you know, as much as you love your children and you think about how all the things you do to protect them, look at it from the standpoint of how serious this is, but look at what we're talking about beginning in verse 18. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and who, when they have chastened him, will not heed them, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him, bring him out to the elders of his city, to the gate of his city, and they shall say to the elders of his city, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is glutton and a drunkard. Then all the men of his city shall stone him to death with stones. So you shall put away the evil from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. I'm just going to throw this out there. What would the world be like if you got rid of that rottenness and parents actually said this and carried that out? I mean, what I'm trying to convey is God was serious about this in his people, that if a parent came to the realization he or she will not obey, that they would take that child to the elders and they would stone their child to death. And yet we think it's cute, or he's just stubborn, or she's just stubborn. That's not what we're talking about when it comes to what we're reading here in the Scriptures. Look at the house of Israel. There's so many here. Ezekiel chapter 3 and verse 7. This is in the prophets when their sins are numbered for them. They are taught why they're being punished, why they will be punished, why they're going to go into captivity. In Ezekiel chapter 3 and verse 7, notice what it says with the prophet. I have flipped past this chapter three times now. Chapter 3 and verse 7. He says, "But the house of Israel will not listen to me because they will not listen to me. For all the house of Israel are impudent and hard-hearted." Hard-hearted. If you look at the footnote for impudent, it says strong of forehead. You know what we have today? We call that he's a hard head. He's headstrong. That's where this comes from. That's stubbornness. That's what we're saying. He's headstrong. He is hard-headed. You can't get anything in there. That's what we're talking about. That does not need to describe certainly any of us. And he also mentions hard-hearted. The heart has been calloused over. Look at Jeremiah chapter 15, verse 1 through 3. Jeremiah chapter 15, verse 1 through 3. And this was all I could find to kind of illustrate that. Jeremiah chapter 5, I should say, not 15. Jeremiah 5, verse 1 through 3. "Run to and fro through the streets of Jerusalem, and see now and know, and seek in her own place, if you can find a man. If there is anyone who executes judgment, who seeks the truth, and I will pardon her. Though they say, 'Alas, the Lord lives,' surely they swear falsely. O Lord, are not your eyes on the truth? You have stricken them, and they have not grieved. You have consumed them, but they have refused to receive correction. They have made their faces harder than a rock. They have refused to turn." Isn't that something? That's what we're talking about. Obstinate stubbornness. In Isaiah chapter 48, Isaiah chapter 48, and in verse 4, Isaiah 48 and verse 4, he says, "Because I knew that you were obstinate and your neck was as an iron sinew." So it's like your neck is just stiffened up. But you notice he says there that you were obstinate. You may have a footnote, hard, hard. Hosea chapter 4 and verse 16. I want you to see this one as well. And I haven't told a lot of the cow stories that I have, but growing up there was a lot of memories that I had of the cows that we had and the stubbornness of cows. In Hosea chapter 4 and verse 16, "For Israel is stubborn like a stubborn calf. Now the Lord will let them forage like a lamb in open country." Well, what are some of the things? Well, we think of bullheaded. That's another way of talking about being stubborn. You know, there's the stubborn as a mule, right? Stubborn as a mule. It's interesting how these qualities show up in animals but are not to show up in the character of God's people. It's very telling, isn't it, that the word heart expresses stubbornness, and it's connected to the head, the heart, the face, the neck. And in the New Testament, it is the stiff-necked Jews who reject Jesus. It is the stiff-necked Jews that stone Stephen. But when you think about how God abhors evil and he hates stubbornness because it's iniquity and it's just like idolatry, well, what's some of the opposite things? Well, this shows in this little illustration of the opposite is yielding, compliant, pliable, flexible, docile, willing, submissive, reasonable. And so you see in that some of the traits that we're looking at. And so here's two last passages. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. Well, somebody has to yield, right? And so it is the idea of we do yield. We have to compromise at times. We do have to... Now, again, we're not talking about conviction and standing for the faith once delivered. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about, you know, what restaurant are we going to go eat at? And we dig in. And it's like 4-1. You know, it's like you're just being stubborn and everybody else wants Chinese, but you're dead set on you're going to get your fried chicken. You know, and it creates a mess and you create a scene out here in the world. And, you know, just all the ways that can play out. And then I thought of James chapter 3 and verse 17. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. You see, Saul lost his kingdom because he was stubborn and he didn't obey God. And that's how God saw it. He said, well, I'm going to take the kingdom away from you. And here's the thing that we need to understand. How sad to miss the glories of heaven because the Lord says you were stubborn. Spending eternity in the devil's hell because you were stubborn. Now, again, I could have put that slide up. It's like, well, it's him, it's her, it's them, it's they. But it's not a quality for any of us. And it's so easy to see it in others, but so often we fail to see it in ourselves. I hope that that's been helpful in some way. If you're here this morning, I should say, and you have sin in your life, you need to confess that sin, then humble yourself and don't be stubborn about it and don't let your heart get calloused over. But if things need to be right, made right, then make that right before it's everlastingly too late. If you need to obey the gospel, don't dig in, surrender your will and obey that gospel so that you can stand before God justified. You remember that's what we talked about around the table. It's that blood of Jesus Christ that will cleanse you and put you in the right relationship with God. And you can do that this morning. We're going to sing an invitation song, and we invite you to come if you're subject to the invitation. As together we stand and sing.